Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. And on today's show, we have Tom Terwilliger, former IFBB pro bodybuilder. Tom's always a great guest, very articulate, very well-spoken guy. We talked to Tom a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, when we did our Bob Gruskin tribute, when we also had Richard Pelletano and John DeFendis and Jerry Scalise with Tom. So the reason I brought Tom back is I saw this post on Facebook by Sean Ray, and Sean was talking about the 1988 Mr. Olympia, one of my favorite Mr. Olympias, where all the bodybuilders in that show were in great condition, and a lot of them had some really, really great posing routines. And the point of Sean's post on Facebook was to talk about how the posing routines back in the day were so iconic and how we associate certain songs with some bodybuilders' routines. And I totally agree with them. So I tried to get Tom and Sean on the podcast to talk about the posing, because Tom was also a fantastic poser. I don't think he ever won a pro show, but I think he took second a couple of times at the Niagara Falls pro show. But Tom did a really fantastic routine at the 1989 and the 1991 Mr. Olympia. And Peter McGough even mentioned it as one of the best routines he ever saw. So I thought I would bring Tom on the show, and we could talk to Tom about how he got started in bodybuilding in the 1970s and how his posing evolved and what he did to make his posing routine so memorable. And Sean was supposed to be on the show with us, but Sean thought that the interview was the following day, so he never joined us. And then halfway through our interview, he did call us. So next week, we will have another interview with Tom and with Sean Ray. So this week it's just with Tom Terwilliger, and we have a really, really great interview about the art of posing, which is something that really seems to be forgotten in today's bodybuilding world. And at the end of our podcast, I'm going to read another article. This was sent to us by our friend of the show, Pat Comer. I used to compete with Pat back in Illinois, back in Chicago. He's a natural bodybuilder. And Pat has a great collection of bodybuilding magazines, and he sent me this interview with the director of Hercules in New York, which was Arnold's very first movie that came out in 1970. And a lot of versions of that, they dub Arnold's voice. And Arnold was actually referred to as Arnold Strong, not Arnold Schwarzenegger. And so this was Arnold's first movie. And the director of that movie went on to do many, many other movies. He had a long career. So they interviewed this director. I think the article is from 2014. It was when The Rock's Hercules movie came out, and that was why they did this interview with this director. So I thought it was really interesting. He's got some really good insights into Arnold when Arnold was a young man. So I'm going to read that article as soon as we get done with our interview with Tom Terwilliger. All right, and before we get to that, I want to mention our sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels so you can maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number, 813-922-8939, or you can reach them at their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. Tell them that you heard the ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they will give you a free consultation. Plus, they will also give you 20% off your first order. All right. So how's it going in your neck of the woods, guys? Out here in Florida, they opened up the gyms yesterday, Monday. So everybody, I went to the gym to work out, and it was packed. It was like New Year's Day, like it was just January 2nd. It was absolutely packed. Everybody was anxious to work out. Everybody's still texting on their phones, of course, but that didn't change. But the gym was packed, and everybody is happy out here in Florida now because we can finally get to the gym and work out. I think it was 8 weeks, more than 8 weeks. It was like over 2 months because I think it was mid-March when all this started. So it's been a long, long drought. Everybody, all the bodybuilders are finally happy to finally be back in the gym and got a good workout in yesterday. I'm going in today to do some legs. So everybody's going to be a little sore, and I'm sure everybody's weak right now, but it should be great. There's also a great documentary on Michael Jordan and the Bulls that was on ESPN. I don't know if you guys caught it. It's called The Last Dance. So if you haven't checked that out, go to ESPN, see if you can catch it. It was a 10-part documentary and covered the 1997-98 season of the Bulls, which was their last championship win. They won six championships, six NBA titles. And it goes back and goes over Michael Jordan's career and all the other championships series they won from 91, 92, 93, and then 95, 96, and 97. Was that it, right? No, I think it was 96, 97, 98. Yeah, it was really, really great. I mean, Michael Jordan, it's just so awesome to see him at his peak. And I didn't realize how competitive he was, but I never really followed his career that closely. Even growing up in Chicago, I think I only watched the championship games. I never watched the whole season. So getting to see Michael and hear his interviews and hear how hungry he was to win, it was just really, really motivating. So check that out if you get a chance. All right, we did get some emails, so I appreciate any emails you guys want to send me. If you have any comments on the show or any questions about anything, just send it to naturalolympia@gmail.com. And my other website, of course, is johnhansonfitness.com if you're interested in training or diet programs, which hopefully we will get some people doing that now because gyms are open, so people can work out now. So that's awesome. All right, let's see what we got here. We got a letter here from Steven, and he says, "Hola, amigo. I was listening to part two of the latest Jerry Branium podcast. Goodness, you two guys are wonderful speaking together. It's so apparent your love for the sport. Just another thought of another possible idea for your podcast. You both touched on it. The silhouettes of the former bodybuilders from the golden era. Come on. How have I not thought of this before? Holy cow. That image, the superhero silhouette, is exactly why most of us ever started lifting. Now all the silhouettes look exactly the same. A big, stupid, ugly block that no one wants. I think this is a valid idea which can stand on its own. Sheesh, there were so many different types of bodies and builds back then." All right, that is a pretty good idea. I don't know how we would talk about that on the podcast, but yeah, we might try that out. I got a letter here from, this is from Matt Craig. Matt was in my John Hansen Fitness Challenge that I started in January, and it ended on April 13th, about a month ago. So Matt was in fantastic shape. He did a great transformation, and he actually got second place in the contest. And I'm going to have that article up on johnhansonfitness.com soon. I know I'm way, way behind. I did do an interview with Paul Aliota, who was the winner of the John Hansen Fitness Challenge. And so that it will also be coming up on YouTube. I'm editing it right now. I'm way behind on all this stuff because it's just hard to get everything done when I have to work a full-time job. But anyways, Matt was in second place. And it was really close, actually, between Matt Craig and Paul. Paul is a younger guy. He's in his 30s. Matt is older like me. I think he's in his early 50s, and he made an amazing transformation in only 12 weeks. So when I get this article up, I'll let you guys know. Check out johnhansonfitness.com, and it should be up there soon. You'll see the amazing shape that Matt got into in only 12 weeks. So anyways, he said, "Hi, John. It's been crazy the last couple of weeks, but I want to thank you for the books and the DVDs you sent me." Matt got all the books and DVDs that I do by taking second place. That was part of the prizes. He said, "I started reading some of The Diary of a Natural Bodybuilder. I believe this is the best book I've ever seen on bodybuilding and contest preparation. You cover everything from A to Z. I'm looking forward to reading the other book also. Plus, I'm sure the DVD is very inspirational. My wife gave me your Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends book for my birthday, so I have plenty to keep me busy reading. Thanks again for the challenge you sponsored with Old School Labs. It's what I needed to push me. And once I signed up, I didn't want to let you down after all the help you gave me. I'm still sticking to the diet for the most part. My gym is open, so I started your 4-day training routine using heavier weights and getting great pumps. My weight is still at 202 pounds, but I feel more like I filled out more. Jack Titone told me today that you look about 15 pounds from being in contest shape. You're doing my natural show this summer. Time to commit. That is my goal, but I'll leave him in the dark for a little while longer. Thanks again, John. You're one of the most knowledgeable people in bodybuilding, and I feel lucky to know you. All right. Thank you very much, Matt. And again, congratulations to you. You made some fantastic progress in only 12 weeks, and I know it was tough with the gym's closing, but it sounds like Matt's got his own gym, so he might have been okay there. I got another email here from Nitin, N-I-T-I-N. He said, Mr. Hansen, I hope you're doing well given these crazy times. I got your email from your latest YouTube video. If you offer training or diet tips for future YouTube videos, could you consider making one on gaining mass for skinny guys? Yeah, that's a good topic. All right, I got another email here from Mike Justice. Mike says, hi, John, I'm a huge fan. I have one of your books that I've read many times while contemplating whether to compete or not. I also subscribe to your YouTube channel. Like you, I'm a natural lifter. I'm not competing, but I'm doing a photo shoot on June 20th of this year. I've been cutting now since November, about a pound per week, so I plan on being in the mid-170s by that time. I'm still carrying a lot of fat in my midsection, but I think that's mostly water. I'm not sure. Is there a way to tell how much water you're carrying as opposed to muscle? I took your suggestion in your book, and I bought a body fat caliper, and while I'm dropping pounds, I'm not losing much fat, at least according to the calipers. I really appreciate your videos and your books. Sincerely, Mike. Well, Mike, when I'm losing fat, I usually go by my waist size. I think the calipers are good. I would do the calipers maybe once a month. Basically, the way the calipers work is they grab a section of your fat and then they measure it. And then you're able to see if those inches are going down, basically. Usually you do your thigh, your waist, and your chest. And then you put those measurements together, and that's how you get your total body fat. But if you just measure your waist, you'll be able to tell if your body fat is going down, because men especially, we put on fat first on the waist. So that's what I do when I'm dieting. I usually do it every day, actually. You don't have to do it every day, but I would do it at least once a week. Just measure your waist, and the same with your weight. And your waist should be going down. Your weight will go down also as you're losing fat. But your waist size, you want to make sure that goes down every single week. And when I do consultations with people, I have them do that. I have them measure their waist every week, and they have to tell me what their waist size is at least once a week. If their waist isn't going down, then I have to make adjustments in their diet. And you should do the same thing. If your waist isn't going down, that means you're not losing fat. So you have to adjust something. And I usually just adjust the diet. I'll usually cut the calories a little bit, maybe cut the carbs a little bit. But you have to adjust something. It doesn't have to be a huge change. There should be some kind of change because your body's not changing. So you have to make sure that you're on the right amount of calories, the right amount of carbs, where your body's going to continually lose fat. It's not going to lose fat super fast, and you don't want to lose it super fast because you want to keep your muscle mass, and you want to have the energy to go into the gym and train heavy, because it's important to keep training heavy and hard as you're losing the fat. That's the challenging part of this whole thing. But it should be under your maintenance level, so you're slowly losing that fat each week. So I would just measure your waist. As far as the water goes, if your diet is the same every day, which it should be, you're not going to be retaining water. You should be also taking in some sodium, because the sodium will help with the muscle contraction. So there's no reason to like cut out your sodium. You should be eating basically the same diet every day. And if that diet is the correct diet, like I said, you'll be losing that fat slowly each week. The only time I ever retain water is if I would go to a restaurant and eat a meal, and they use insane amounts of sodium with their meals. And then you'll notice it the next day. You'll probably put on like 5, maybe even 10 pounds of weight just because of all the sodium, especially if you're eating a well-controlled diet that you're eating the same thing every day. You'll really notice that sodium increase. But normally you won't see a lot of sodium or a lot of water retention on your diet. Now, you can adjust your carbs and your water the last week before a photo shoot or before a contest to get rid of any little bit of water, but you won't be retaining water as you go along. So just go by your waist size. And like I said, you can do those body fat calipers, do that maybe once a month. Usually what I would do when I was getting ready for a show is I would take total body measurements, which would be my chest, my waist, my arms, my thighs, my calves. I would do that once a month, but every week I would definitely check my waist and my weight. You don't want to let that go too long, because if you go for a month and you haven't checked your waist, and then you find out after a month it's exactly the same, you just wasted a whole month. So you want to be on top of that. Like I said, I do it every day. because I want to know where it's at. Usually when I do my weight and my waist every day, my weight will vary during the week. Sometimes it might go up a little, sometimes it might go down, but each week it'll probably eventually go down. So if you're looking at it on a weekly basis, you'll see a drop in the weight, but the waist should definitely be going down every week. So I hope that helps you out. All right, I think that's all the emails I got. Hey guys, if you listen to our show also on Apple iTunes, please give it a rating. Give us a 5-star rating if you could, and also leave messages there. I didn't get any messages this week on there. So leave me a message and let me know. That helps our rating, I guess, with Apple iTunes. And like I said, if you want to send me any emails, just send them to naturalolympia@gmail.com. Also, I did want to thank Pat Comer again. He sent me this. I don't know if you guys ever read it. It's that article about the 1980 Olympia, which we're coming up on 40 years now of this contest. And it's called The Intangible Arnold, The Controversial Mr. Olympia Contest of 1980. It's written by John Fair. And I think when I interviewed Boyer Coe and also Roger Walker, they mentioned this article. It's really, really good. I would love to read it on the air here, but it's like 22 pages. It's way too long. But it's really, really good. If you ever get a hold of it on the internet or anything, it's called The Intangible Arnold. And it was from a newsletter maybe called Iron Game History, Volume 11, Number 1. So check that out and look for that. Maybe I'll do a podcast on this article because it was really, really interesting. He really goes into the detail about the judges and how the judging went on and the people Arnold knew, and it's really, really interesting. So check that out, and thanks to Pat Comer for sending that to me. All right, without further ado, here is our interview with the great Tom Terwilliger, where we talk about the art of posing. Here we go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and my special guest this week is Mr. Tom Terwilliger. Tom was the 1986 NPC Nationals Light Heavyweight Champion, and he went on to compete in many pro shows, including the Mr. Olympia. And our topic today, Tom, is something you were very good at, which was posing. So I saw a post recently by Sean Ray, and Sean was talking about the 1988 Olympia. And he was talking about in that show how great all the posing was. And even guys who weren't known for their posing really put in the effort and tried to really make great posing routines. And you were known always for your posing, especially, we'll get to this later, the 89 Olympia, where you really came up with this great routine. So I wanted to bring you on so we could talk about that.
Absolutely. I wish Sean could be here joining us. And maybe we'll do this again sometime with him and kind of reminisce a little bit about, because it's great to bounce these things around. And you're terrific at this as well, because you know the era. And the era I'm talking about, of course, is the 80s and even into the 90s, because many of the great bodybuilders that came up the amateur ranks in the 80s were the top pros into the 90s.
Right.
And again, I think certainly there's a lot of commonality there. And much of it, of course, is being reflected in today's classic physique pursuits, you might say, right? It was a different lines. It was different symmetry. There was something aesthetically, really aesthetically appealing, that was coming out of that era. Certainly, even before that. Yeah. But I think the 80s, in many respects, personified that classic physique look with a little more refined, perhaps, than the 60s or the 70s, with the lines and the Frank Zanes really kind of brought it to life. But the 80s kind of started to refine it. It was a little more muscularity and the same level of symmetry and proportion as a result. But again, this other commonality was the posing. Was that, and this is perhaps one of the reasons why I was compelled for many reasons to really work hard and try and excel in terms of the posing. And I'll share some of those reasons. But a good part of it had to be because freaking everybody was good.
Everybody
posed. I mean, the in my opinion, it's like, and listen, I hope I'm not selling anyone short. If I am, forgive me. When I talk about no one today is really stepping up to that level, I'm sure, since I'm not completely informed and watching everyone that's competing on either the classic physique or the bodybuilding stage today at the highest level, that there are those who are stepping up and really putting a focus and emphasis on it. So forgive me when I say, no one today, the best today in posing wouldn't even compare to the worst poser in the 80s. Because everybody put an emphasis on it, you know?
Yeah, that was Sean's point, I think, is that in the 1980s, it was like everybody wanted to do that. So, Tom, we just did an interview with you recently where we were giving a tribute to Mr. Bob Gruskin, mm-hmm. who passed away. And we had you and Jerry Scalise and John DeFendis on, and you guys were talking about your early days when you started as teenagers in the 1970s. So let's go back to that. And when you did your first show, what was your posing routine like, and what were your influences then?
Well, certainly my influence, the greatest influence in my posing, bar none, was on, and I can't remember the exact year, but I think I started competing in around 76 or 77, I think. It was 77. In fact, John DeFendis and I competed in a couple of the same shows. We didn't know each other at the time. But when I went to see the opening of Pumping Iron in Manhattan, and I tell you something, I was a punk-ass teenage kid who was doing a little working out because I wanted to be a little bit more strong. I wanted to be a little bit more of an athlete for lacrosse. And some of my fellow lacrosse players in junior high school were like joining me on this. It was like we had a couple of gyms in this guy's basement. We had a gym in this guy's basement, just some dumbbells and stuff like that. Right. And we were working out. And we saw somebody show me a magazine, came to my locker and says, "You got to see this, man." I think it was Tom Mahoney, a friend of mine. And he says, "You got to see this." And it was Muscle Builder magazine, and had the cover, on the cover was Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, with his arm blaster on. He's doing his curl. I was like, "What in hell?" And I sort of flipping through his page. I go, "Holy crap." It took the training to another level. It completely changed my focus, completely. And in those pages, they were talking about a movie that was just coming out, Pumping Iron.
Yeah.
And that it was going to be – oh, it was actually in that Muscle and Fitness magazine, Muscular Development magazine. And it was talking about it was going to be opening in Manhattan and where it was. So here I was with my buddies. It was about six or seven of us. And we were maybe 15 years old, you know, somewhere in that area. And admittedly, we smoke a bunch of dope. We jump on the Long Island Railroad. We go to the theater, and we sit down, and we're, like, not expecting much. And then before the movie, they had, like, four or five guest posers.
Yeah.
There was Lou Ferrigno, I think Robbie Robinson, a couple others. But the routine – and the guy wasn't even in his best shape by far. I mean, he was in decent shape, but not even really good shape. Ed Carney.
Right.
And Ed Carney's posing just sent shivers up my spine. And it was from that moment, it made such an impression on me at that early age that as much as I wanted the muscle, it was like in my mind, I wanted to move an audience. I wanted to move people's minds and their spirits and their emotion the way he moved me.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it had the same impact. I doubt it had the same impact on my fellow travelers, my theater goers, because none of them wound up pursuing it at the same level that I did. But clearly it was a life-altering experience for me to not just see those guys and then to watch the movie. The movie just was the catalyst to it all, you know?
So you guys go to see this movie, and before the movie, they had these guys come out and guest pose.
Live guest posing.
Wow. Did they pose the music, or did they just come out and pose it?
No, they posed the music. And in fact, I think Ed Carney posed to 2001 Space Odyssey. Remember? I mean, that was like everybody in those days wanted to pose to that.
Right.
But he owned it.
Yeah.
He owned it. He was in, and again, I don't recognize it as much. You know, maybe he wasn't even close to the zone, but he was like present. He was in it. He was part, and the way he moved and just turned and the music. And I was just like, oh my God. As a teenager, it was in every cell of my body. And it was something that just moved me to be able to, not just for myself, but to create an experience for an audience, you know, and to this day, I think that along with some other experiences, the movie itself was the catalyst to pursuing it to the level I did. But certainly,
cool. You know, I remember reading about that they were doing posing exhibitions in New York at certain shows. This wasn't the premiere, right? This was just a regular showing.
Actually, no, this was the premiere. This was the premiere. And I don't know if it was premiering anywhere else, but it was New York. It was the New York premiere of Pumping Iron.
Okay.
Yep. So it was the first time anyone had seen, you know, in a large audience had seen the movie.
Yeah.
And to promote it, they were having all these guys there, you know?
Right.
It was pretty cool.
Yeah, I remember reading the magazines back then, and I remember Ed Corney talking about that, how he had a pose at all these theater shows.
Yeah. This was the opening in Manhattan. So, and again, I wasn't, I didn't go to Manhattan a lot. I was living in Long Island, so it was a bit of a trek, but I had to go, man.
I had to be there,
and I was so glad I did.
Yeah. So when you did go ahead, Tom.
I'm sorry.
When you did your first teenage show, what kind of posing routine did you do? Having that influence by that,
I want to look back and say it was magnificent, but I'm sure it was as clumsy and amateur as anybody's.
Yeah,
but maybe a step up because of that influence. I look back now and I look at some of the pictures, even with me and John Defendez at the Suburban, which I think was the first competition I did. It was at a small YMCA in East Orange, New Jersey. It was about an hour and a half drive from Long Island. And, it's kind of interesting to think back to and have been part of a time when it was just out of its infancy in many respects, This was AAU at the time, American Athletic Union. And the auditorium was a basketball gym floor, and they had a little podium with a little spotlight overhead. It was like a simple light, and that was it. There was no pump-up room. There's some curtains so you could pump up a little behind, backstage.
Yeah.
And
that was the same year, right, Tom? Was that 77?
That was 77.
Yeah, same year the movie came out, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it was the same year. And I'd already been working out for lacrosse. So it was like, take it up to the next level. Join the gym. That was another inspiration, joining a real gym called Future Man and being inspired by a great champion, Tony Pandolfo.
Yeah.
But when I look back at those pictures, John, I can see that there was some effort going into the posing. And part of that might have been because I hadn't really been working with Bob Gruskin yet, but I was working a little bit with Tony Pandolfo. I was watching. I was observing. I was looking at guys in the magazine. Certainly Frank Zane was one of my inspirations. So I can even see from those early pictures, the angle, the double bicep with the angle, the hip out. And it was just like, that wasn't just like, there was some effort going into it, So I don't particularly remember the routine. I'm sure it was a basic, this one here, and I know I did a twisting back shot. I did some kind of vacuum, some things that might have been a little unusual, but not terribly unusual. But I think what made the difference even then was, and I should say this, that I had a lot of earlier kung fu training. So I had trained in Chinese kung fu from the time I was about 8 years old until about that time when I discovered bodybuilding, because the interest in bodybuilding kind of usurped my interest in kung fu at that time. It sort of took its place. But the ability to be able to move, to do the tai chi, the kung fu movement, all translated into the posing. So I think that even though the basic movements were just that, basic, I think the transitions were something a little probably above and beyond. But certainly nothing great, I don't think.
Did you pick out like certain professional bodybuilders that you were trying to imitate them? Did you get certain poses from some of the guys?
Yeah, that's a astute question that would only come from another bodybuilder who's done the same thing. Because that's exactly right. I mean, is what we had to do.
Yeah,
and I think some of the guys were making was like the mistake I would have or could have made would be trying to pose like Arnold or look like Arnold.
Yeah.
I don't have that physique. I don't have that body. Right. I couldn't do Franco Colombo. It's just like,
yeah.
So I was very fortunate that also around that time that Frank Zane was emerging as a Mr. Olympia and one of the top competitors,
Mm-hmm.
And, being about 185 pounds, same height, similar stature, that I was like, okay. So I started studying how he poses, how he shapes, how he creates this illusion, you might say,
Yeah.
And absolutely. And just literally in my mirror in the basement, looking at the pictures, comparing what I'm doing, and so absolutely influenced by several of them. But certainly Frank Zane was the early influence in terms of the actual poses themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, I've coached people with posing. And I think one of the mistakes that a lot of people make is they see a bodybuilder back in the magazines when we used to see, or probably now on YouTube, and they'll see a pose they do and they go, oh, I love that pose. But that pose doesn't fit their physique. They might try to do a vacuum pose, but maybe they might not look good in a vacuum pose.
Yeah.
They might try to do a most muscular type pose, but they might have more of a Frank Zane type physique. So it doesn't look good on that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think that's
that classic most muscular. unless you're thick.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work. Do something. No. Find the one that does. I mean, Frank Zane, you never saw Frank Zane do that.
No, very rarely.
Did the hands on the hip.
Hands on hip.
Might have done a hands. I don't even think you never did one in the front at all.
No, right? I don't think so either. No.
No?
Yeah. So when you guys started competing back in the 70s, Tom, did you pose the music or was that later on?
Yeah, we definitely posed the music.
Okay.
It was a little more challenging then because, of course, you couldn't edit music, really. It was hard.
Yeah.
I do remember, actually taking a tape and cutting it and splicing it to try and get it,
Wow.
Because we only had 60 seconds, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the song didn't crescendo for, 3 minutes. You know what I mean? I got to get this part. I got to get the beginning and this part, right?
Right.
You, cut it and you taped it together. Yeah. You hope like hell that it doesn't break in the middle of your performance, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, we have music, but it was fairly basic at the time.
Okay.
But it did add that choreography a little bit to it. You know what I mean? And again, that's something that even early on, I tried to pay attention. I recommend that athletes today pay attention to that choreography, because when you're hitting a pose, it should be punctuated by the music. Yeah. Not off sync with the music. There's an emotion that comes with a beat or a word or a song or a melody that comes. And if you're off sync, your audience feels that. They know it. They know there's something out of sync.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't register the same way. It doesn't have the same emotional impact. So even then, it was clear to me that, hey, you know what? If I stretch this just for a fraction of a second or a boom, I can hit it on that note instead of being ahead of it or behind it.
You were learning this as a teenager.
It makes sense to me to do that.
Yeah. Did you notice all the other teenagers you were competing with, were they also trying to make an effort and do these good routines?
I think there were a couple of guys. I don't remember a lot of them doing it. But again, like I said, even then, there was either some of the basic posing was even, I mean, everybody made some level of effort for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think there was a lot of, really paying that much attention to it going on. There was a couple of guys, Dwayne Broadway, who was competing around that time. He was a great bodybuilder. He was always a very good showman. He played music that was great. And it wasn't so much that he had really well choreographed routines, but from my recollection, it was just his excitement, his enthusiasm, and his ability to dance. I'm sure the guy was a freaking disco maniac. You know what I mean? Yeah. He was just he knew how to dance. So he brought that a little bit into the routine, and he played music that was kind of exciting and fun. There was a couple other guys. Some of the guys I remember competing back in those early days, guys like Ron Tufel.
Yeah.
For example, I don't know how many people remember Ron, but he was great.
Yeah.
I think he took second at the Mr. America to Tony Pearson 1 year or something.
He was in it. I think Ron won the Teenage America in 75, and I think he was only 18. And then I think when he was 19, I think he came in the top three in his class at the Mr. America in 76.
We were just
talking about Pat Nevey. I think Pat might have won his class, and I think Ron might have been second at 19.
Wow.
Yeah, he was amazing, man. He was great.
I remember, as a teenager, not to get off subject with the posing, but I remember going to, he competed all around my area at many of the same shows.
He was from Pennsylvania, right?
Yeah. And so he was in the Suburban, he was in the Apollo, some of the different shows I competed in. And I don't think I ever competed against him as a teenager. He was always thank God. I mean, it just would have been embarrassing. You know what I mean? Ron would have walked off with his tail between. No, I would have been the one that embarrassed. He was, but I remember being like dumbfounded by the thickness, you know?
Yeah,
and the crazy density of his muscles, man, you know?
Right.
He never had a pleasing aesthetic physique because he was a little blocky.
Yeah.
But I also remember even Ron, capitalizing on his physique.
Hmm.
He knew how to pose for his body.
Yeah.
You know? And he did it well. And I forget, the music also probably complimented it because I remember it being fairly dramatic.
Yeah. So when we go into the 1980s, and I agree with you, I think, maybe I'm biased because that was kind of my era too, you know, and they say you always choose whatever your era is. But
True.
The 1980s to me, it seemed like you said, the physiques had advanced from the 70s and the posing was much improved. But it didn't get too freaky. I think when you got to the 90s, the guys were getting crazy huge, But the 80s, it was more relatable, I guess, to the average person. Like, I think exactly. If you read Muscle and Builder or Muscle and Fitness, a guy could look at, you know, someone like you or Lee Haney even, or Barry DeMay, or, you know, Bob Paris, and say, wow, I want to look like that, you know. And mm-hmm. I could look like that if I went to the gym and really worked hard, you know. But right. The posing was great. So do you think the posing was so good in the 80s because a lot of the guys our age were influenced by, like, Pumping Iron and Ed Corney and Arnold?
I think so. You know, and right. Again, if you go back to the movie that we were all watching, I mean, I can't imagine anybody, Barry DeMay, I can't imagine like Sean Ray, I mean, Rick Sparrow, Lee Haney, everyone was influenced by that movie. There's yeah, no denying, absolutely. And the book, of course, Pumping Iron, the book. Mm-hmm. And I love the glimpse into the second aspect of the sport, which is that posing aspect, the presentation, right? They yeah. talked about it in the movie. They even have Arnold and Franco in a ballet class being taught by a dancer how to move right. their body. And it's just like, okay.
The opening scene of the movie, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, how do you not be influenced, whether we acknowledged it or not? It's sort of like watching a really good drama. You know, when the things you remember consciously was the shootout and the fight scene is like, oh, remember that fight scene?
Yeah.
The things that infiltrate our unconscious might be something on a totally different level. And so the first scene, that opening scene in Pumping Iron, infiltrated the unconscious of the would-be wannabe bodybuilder at that time. And it emphasized the importance of it.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of guys, because if you really look at, and we mentioned a couple of names, if you look at some of the bodybuilding routines, I mean, Bob Paris's routine, just magnificent. It was designed to emphasize his physique, the art of the sport, the art of posing, to bring the human physique, the sculpture to life.
Yeah.
And it literally did. Sean Ray's posing was just it's magical to watch.
Yeah.
The physique clearly is emphasized and it's magnificent, but the posing, Lee Labrada, again, another 80s graduate into the pro ranks of the 90s. Yeah. Just magnificent posing. And Lee's ability to be able to accentuate his physique. He wasn't the biggest guy on stage. He never was going to be.
Right.
He had a relatively weak set of latissimus muscles. His lats weren't super wide.
Right.
But he knew how to pose to bring out his best. And I don't want to get too ahead of ourselves because this is a slightly, not off topic, but a slightly different component of the topic, which is presence. Mm-hmm. And if you look at, I mean, everyone posed, and we can talk more about the posing itself and what may, like, the components that go into it, what goes into it, the mindset, the practice levels, what goes into really creating a dynamic posing routine. But more than anything else, and it dawns on me as I'm thinking about, I'm visualizing, you know, Barry DeMay and Rich Gasparri and Lee Labrada and Sean, myself, several others, you know, just like everybody, just like, man, if you watch these guys, there was a presence, a stature and a presence.
Yeah.
Lee Labrada had a tremendous presence on stage at whatever he was, 5'6", 5'7". His presence was enormous.
Yeah.
Lee Haney's had the same presence. Fortunately, he was bigger individual anyway, but it was the presence, the stature that these bodybuilders brought to the stage and then sort of transferred through their posing routines that created the dynamic that existed then that we're having a hard time seeing as much of today, I think.
Yeah, yeah. So if you go back to the beginning of the 80s, I'm thinking like McAway from the 80s.
Fantastic.
82, 83 Olympia. I remember that was shown on NBC Wide World of Sports. And I mean, even like the most hardcore rugged bodybuilders would be so impressed by that guy. I mean, he posed the Chariots of Fire, I think. And it was just the way he moved his arms and the way, I mean, it was like magic, man. It was just, now McAway was a guy who was like 5'2", winning pro shows. And I think a lot of it was because of the posing.
Yep, absolutely. And it goes back to that stature thing again, that presence on stage. It's almost like, and I'd love to talk a little bit about the mindset as we progress a little bit further into the conversation, because the mindset of how to create that kind of presence on stage, when the stakes are high, you might say, you know?
But his
posing, he was so impressive. And he had a look, you know, he just had a great, like the whole package was there, the look. He wasn't a big guy by any means. But you're right, the posing, and it's just – you know, and it's interesting because I think a lot of people who've never seen Muhammad Macaway standing next to someone else mm-hmm. might never know he was only 5'2 or 5'3.
Yeah. You know? No, you would
in fact,
never
I remember,
know.
I'm only 5'8. I remember being in Germany at the FIBO, and some big giant German guy comes up to me and I'm signing autographs, and he's like, Tom Twilliger. I thought you'd be much bigger. So it's like, it's the illusion.
Yeah.
And the posing really, it just was captivating to watch.
Yeah. And if you look at McAway's career, I mean, he started off, he won the Universe in 1976. And then I remember going to a lot of those Frank Zane Olympias in the late 70s in Columbus. Yeah. And McAway was in a lot of those shows. And he didn't do well. He would place like 7th or 8th.
Wow.
He was thick, yeah, but he was off, you know. And then he started working with Vince Gironda.
Mm-hmm.
Vince Gironda told him, like, how to get ripped, but also told him how to pose.
Yeah.
So when he came back in the early 80s, man, that guy was a totally different bodybuilder. He was more ripped, but like you said, he had that presence, and he was winning pro shows, taking second in the Olympia 2 times in a row.
Yeah.
5'2". I mean, that's inconceivable. 5 foot two.
Unbelievable. And yeah. I tell you what, Vince Gironda, a name popped in my head, and I don't want to make sure I'm not remiss in not mentioning him, because another guy who was a great poser, but I want to go back to Vince Gironda for a second, because that, again, supersedes even, you know, all of the bodybuilders from the 80s who came from the 70s, where Vince Gironda was really an influence, you know?
Yeah.
But I do want to make sure, maybe we can bring him up again later, but Samir Banut, you know, I love Samir, and we did a Grand Prix tour together, and we went to a couple of different events, you know, post competition together. I just really kind of, he was a crazy son of a bitch. But I love him. I just love the guy. And in fact, you and I ran into you for the first time in person, along with Samir.
Yeah.
You guys were entertaining an audience, quite the audience.
At the old school labs booth, yeah.
At the, right. That's right, at the Olympia a year or two ago. So I just want to make sure that it's impossible to overlook him, but when the name pops into my head, I have to mention it, because he's just a artful poser, and just, again, you're being able to, you know, maximize his physique with the type of posing he was doing. But let's talk about Vince Gironda for a minute. Wouldn't that have been an experience? Because if you look at early Vince Gironda's, and who knows really how to pronounce his name, for God's sake, but some of the early poses, I mean, that guy was early on doing the open hands,
yeah,
and the twisting back shots and the stuff like that. I mean, he was thin, but he was great, and I can
imagine, aesthetic too, very ripped and very aesthetic.
Very aesthetic, yeah. I can imagine working, and he worked with some great champions, man. He worked with some great guys.
Well, it's funny too when you go back in the history. I remember Corny told me that he was influenced. Not told me, but I remember reading in the magazines. He said that he was influenced by Leo Stern, and Leo Stern used to teach Bill Pearl how to pose.
Really?
Yeah. So then Corny's influenced by Leo Stern. And then I'm sure, like, guys like Chris Dickerson were influenced by Ed Corney. And then McAway was probably influenced by Dickerson.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I know Lee Labrada said he was influenced by McAway. So it's crazy how when you've got these guys who are great posers, people coming up, the younger guys, the new generation, they're influenced by those guys. And maybe that's the problem today, is these guys today don't have influences. They don't have anybody to be influenced.
Yeah, I think we've gotten away from that. I think there's because, again, usually the influence is the generation before.
Yeah.
So if you look at, obviously, Bill Pearl and Leo, what was Leo's last name?
Leo Stern.
Leo Stern. I remember Leo Stern. Again, the generation or two before. And then McAway just before. Lee Labrada starts to climb the ladder. So you're right. A lot of the athletes today don't have that just previous generation.
Yeah.
Because even if you look at, you know, Phil Heath, if you look at Jay Cutler, I mean, you know, okay, they unbelievable physiques. There's no denying.
Yeah, for sure.
You know what I mean? But I don't think there was a tremendous effort put forth in terms of the routines.
Yeah.
And I don't think the routines ever changed. I may be wrong. And again, forgive me, guys, if I am wrong. But a lot of times, too, and this is interesting, because I had a conversation with a top female Miss Olympia competitor not long ago.
Okay.
And I told her, and this was actually about a year and a half ago, and it was just before last year's Olympia. And I asked her, I said, well, what do you think your weakness is? She said, well, my legs have to come up. I said, yeah, they're starting to come up. They could use a little work, but you can hide some of that a little bit too. And she says, my posing could be a little better. And you can, the women posers are fantastic.
Right.
And you can't afford a top fitness, a Miss Olympia competitor cannot afford to have her routine anything but any second best. You cannot be second best, right?
Right, right.
And so I challenged her. I said, here's my challenge to you. I said, well, at first I asked her, I said, so how much effort do you put in? Well, not really. I pretty much do the same thing every year. Or I kind of wing it, you know, based on my music. I said, you really think that's good enough? You're at the Olympia level and that's good enough? She said, well, probably not. I said, well, here's my challenge to you. My challenge is you put 2-3 hours at least a week. Number one, develop a new routine. And if you have to get a choreographer. Develop the new routine and put at least 2 to 3 hours a week into mastering that routine. So when you get on stage, it's second nature.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
So I challenged her to do that. Unfortunately, it fell on deaf ears because she didn't do it. And she said she would. Okay. I'm going to step up to that challenge. She didn't do it. And I can't say as a result, but it's certainly her performance, which was familiar and comfortable, didn't cut it.
Yeah.
Where it might have, you know what, if the judges had said, you know, oh my God, that routine just blew us away. And as a result, you stepped up.
Yeah.
We saw. And that might have made a difference. And so the reason I bring that up is because I think that's what's happening a lot with today's generation.
Yeah.
Do the same thing again and again. One of the things, and again, Sean Ray, we never mentioned Vince Taylor's brilliance on stage as far as his posing, another coming up through the ranks in the 80s. Never really did, maybe once or twice for guest posing, they would repeat routines.
Yeah.
But almost very rarely would come back with the identical routine they did last year.
At a show, yeah. You know? Right.
Right? The physique has changed a little bit. The routine changes a little bit.
Yeah.
So you don't rest on your laurels.
The women bodybuilders, because I did an interview with Corey Everson, and Corey said every year she won her 6 Miss Olympias, she worked really, really hard on a new routine. And it was expected of her that she come in with this great routine. And if you remember the women bodybuilders from the 1980s, they all had great routines.
Oh.
They were all amazing. You know, I think learned a lot from them.
Absolutely. I might want to actually go back and say that was one of my influences as well.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a lot that went into, you know, developing the routines along the way and wanting to have those kind of routines. You know, for me personally, was being around a lot of the female bodybuilders. I was around a lot in the 80s. I did a World Mixed Pairs Championship with Gladys Portuguese, who was one of the top females. And, you know, just one of the sweetest gals you'll ever meet in your life, you know, and just a great gal. And so we worked on a routine together. And then I got to see... As a result of that, I got to see and meet a lot of these, you know, the top female competitors and watch those routines. And in my mind, it's just like, why aren't we doing routines like that?
Right, right.
We got to do, why can't we bring as much magic, you know?
Yeah,
so I'm glad you brought that up because that, now that I think about it, that was an influence without question.
Yeah. And also, as you mentioned earlier about hiding your weak points, you know, like you're talking about Lee Labrada didn't have the biggest back. I remember one of the routines, I think it was the 84 Olympia when McAway got second, and Frank Zane was doing the commentating, and he said, if you notice, like, McAway has weak hamstrings, he's got a weak back, but you'll never see it in his routine because he was emphasizing his arms, his triceps, the sweeping poses. You know, when he did a back shot, it was never a straight-on back shot.
Never.
His weaker back, he would do a twisting back shot, and then your eyes went to his shoulders and his triceps, you know.
Yeah. Do you remember ever seeing a regular straight on back double bicep or even a front double bicep from McCowrie? I don't know if I've ever seen a prejudging, but I don't remember ever seeing a straight on just boom. Right.
Not in his routine, yeah.
Never, yeah. Never.
And Zane was talking about how he did all these hand movements and it was like a magician, you know. Taking the emphasis away from his weak points and putting him on his strong points, you know.
Exactly. Yeah, and the hand movements, and again, one of the components of bringing forth a good routine is coordinating the body together. You know, not just bringing the arms up, but when the hands move, how do they flow up? And again, it doesn't always have to be a McAway or what I used to do with the hands, like a Qigong type thing or Kung Fu thing. It could be something a little bit different, but it should be like the whole body. If you turn the arm, the hip should turn.
Yeah.
The head should move. Your toes, your feet, whatever it might be, there's a shift. There's a subtle shift in everything. I mean, if you picture like, you know, remember the old robotic type routines where you just like everything would just like a little turn here or there, you know what I mean? And so working on that takes a little effort.
Yeah.
That what's the best turn? What's the best quarter? What's the best hand movement, you know?
Well, Corny had those great hand movements. And the way he moved his arms, you know.
Oh, the open palm, the open hand thing. Just like bring it up. And that's what you were watching. And then all of a sudden, it's like, boom, he's in this pose.
Yeah.
You were watching the movement and the dynamic of the movement. And then suddenly it's boom. There it is. You know?
I saw the 77 Olympia when Ed got like two or three standing ovations. That was the year Pumping Iron came out, as you mentioned.
Right.
And then by the time the Olympia came around, everybody knew Corny was the master poser. Yeah. And he killed it. And he was in great shape. He got third place that year. But he killed it with the posing. And then I remember the next year, I was really impressed in 78. I did an interview with Roger Schwab, who was the head judge at the Olympia that year. And he thought Ed was a little bit off that year because Ed only took, I think, seventh, you know, dropping from third. But I thought in 78, I thought he looked great. He was thicker. Maybe his conditioning was a little bit off. But I remember his routine was amazing because he combined these really majestic movements with his arms. And then he would just, like, hit a most muscular part, you know.
Yeah.
It was just so great the way he did it all. I mean, you tell the amount of practice that guy put in must have been incredible, you know.
Well, it was right. Again, absolutely, the practice must have been amazing. But it is that dichotomy between the slow and then boom, suddenly there's this power.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a slow motion punch. And then all of a sudden, an inch from your face, it's like you're faster. You couldn't even see it happen. It's like suddenly you got hit.
They didn't even post the music back then. I mean, that was just, he just got up and posed. And the crowd was crazy. Yeah. The only music was the applause, you know.
Yeah. Just a minute. Yeah, I remember even in Pumping Iron. Remember when Corny's posing?
Yeah.
And they're sitting in the audience, Robbie Robinson and Danny Padilla and Arnold Schwarzenegger. And Arnold's like, now that is posing. Right. And I'm like, you're damn freaking right it is.
And speaking of Corny, too, I remember how he said that when he practiced the pose, everything had to be perfect. The way his hands pointed, the way everything was lined up. Because if one little thing was off, like if your foot was a little bit off or your knee was a little bit off. And I remember John Brown said this, too. Mm. It ruins the whole pose.
You know, I agree.
It's got to all be perfect, you know. Yep. Like, so, and I think Arnold was worse than that too.
Nothing worse than that twisting back.
Yeah,
one arm is like down like this. Like, no.
Yeah, it ruins it. It ruins the whole thing.
Got to be the elbow. It's got to be completely in line with the other elbow. Yeah. You know, and that, but that takes practice. And I don't know. I think we've lost that ability to be able to put that much time and effort into. Because I can remember doing poses, and I've been very blessed to have had coaches, but also training partners. One of my absolute favorites, best training partners, Ron Starantino, who became a celebrity agent. He's been on and did a lot for Sons of Anarchy and several other shows, including The Apprentice. He was one of my best training partners ever. Very successful guy. And I remember when we would work on those routines, so like that Olympia routine, the 89 Olympia routine, that was my training partner. And man, that guy, this is something, advice for anyone and everyone in the sport, in any sport for that matter. Don't surround yourself by the brocebos. And what I mean by the brocebos is, you know what the placebo effect is, right? It's like you can convince yourself that a medication is working or something like that, right? The brocebos can convince you look better than you are. And they're like, oh, bro, you look fucking great, man. You look awesome. You're looking to win this thing. You know what I mean? You're winning, you're crushed.
Right.
And then you're crushed. You'd rather have honesty. You know what I mean? So Ronnie would just like tear me apart, man. He would tear me apart. He's like, no. Turn that hand. You know what I mean? He's like, bring it up. I could see it, but I need it. Like, just like tap the elbow, you know?
Yeah.
And I was like, man. And it was annoying as hell, but ultimately it got into the cells and you remembered it. You remember where it's supposed to be and exactly how it is. The little things, and you know this, John. I mean, just like you hit that ab shot, there's a specific way of hitting your particular ab shot that brings out that serratus, and there's a way of doing it that it doesn't bring it out.
Right.
And if you don't get it right through hours and hours of practice, guess what? It ain't coming out on stage. It's just not.
Right.
And therefore, you're not going to be a best on stage. That's the bottom line.
Right. Yeah, you're right. You really need somebody there to critique your body because you can't, even if you're looking in the mirror, you can't really see it all. I remember when I was getting ready for like the teenage shows I did, my younger brother, he was 1 year younger than me. He was studying art classes. He became a commercial artist. So it was really great how he saw the body aesthetically. And he would say, no, move your arm this way or twist your arm this way. It looks better.
Yeah.
Your waist looks smaller. You know, he could see the body from an artistic viewpoint.
Absolutely. And it's fascinating you bring that up because, again, my training partner, Ronnie, was very instrumental in that. But earlier on was my brother, my twin brother, Mike, who became a great bodybuilder, won the Tri-State and the Metropolitan Championship, was on his way to go into the Nationals. I remember being in the basement because he's an artist. He's an airbrush artist. He's a tattoo artist and just probably one of the most brilliant artists. This art, I don't know how much you can see of it behind me.
Uh-huh.
He did both those pieces in airbrush.
Oh, nice.
It's really good. And he would do the same thing down in my basement when I was a teenager, early 20s. He would do the same thing. And you got to twist it, turn that off. I'm not seeing that teres major, whatever it might be. You know, we got to know the anatomy pretty well. And when you know the anatomy and you know it should be there, but we're not seeing it.
Yeah,
you're either fat or you're not bringing it out, period. Yeah. And he was really instrumental in that early on. I remember that, man. I was very fortunate.
And like you said, the practice time, I remember, you know, same as you, I did the shows in the early 80s and we would I'd get my cassette tape ready and you practice over and over. It was almost like, you know, you went to the gym 6 days a week and you had to practice your posing 6 days a week. I mean,
you had to practice.
And sometimes you didn't feel like it. You're dieting and stuff, but you had to get in your posing trunks. And get in front of the mirror and practice, practice, practice. And that's the only way you got good at it.
I remember that. And again, you know, we honored Bob Gruskin a few weeks back. And God rest his soul, one of the great mentors and coaches of all time. And I think somebody talked about it. It might have been Jerry Scalise was talking about that. You would get in front of that mirror, that puny little mirror that he had down in his basement. And for like what felt like an eternity, man.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, my God. And you know, nobody really wanted to do it. We wanted to be critiqued, you know what I mean? But it's just like he was brilliant at that, man. So yeah. I guess there's a lot of people I have to credit, including Bob, for running you through. And the other thing it did is just like, hey, when you're standing in front of Bob Gruskin's mirror and you're posing and you're having to go through it and you're having to turn the leg in a little bit or turn the leg out a little bit to show that hamstring, flex the glute, whatever it might be that needs to be done, It set up the rule. The rule is you get in front of that mirror and you spend freaking hours. That's it.
Yeah.
You're a bodybuilder. You're an artist. You're doing a sculpture. If you're doing a sculpture, you know, and if you're not stepping back down again to critique it and to take a look at it and see what's missing, what needs to happen next, how do I do this or how do I change that? How do I make it exactly what I want? Then you're missing. You're missing something. And so you have to be able to do that. And I think that's an important part. Not to mention, and you know this, John, that the closer you get to competition, number one, you need the conditioning of standing there posing because there's no relaxing. You know, when you're on stage, right? You're not relaxing. You can't relax. And so you're always semi-flexed, always holding and showing your best. And I remember Bob Gruskin telling me that. He was like, the minute you breathe out and your gut goes out, or the minute you relax, that's when the judges are going to see you.
Right.
And that's what's going to hold in their mind.
Yeah.
He said you can never let them see you like that. You always have to be semi-flexed. And then you got to go through your turns and your quarters and your poses and everything else. So you had better be in posing condition.
Yeah.
You don't have to run a marathon, but it's equivalent to a marathon.
Yeah.
And you better be in shape for it. And the only way to get in shape for it is not training, not working out. It's posing itself to be able to hold that, you know, and the breathing.
Too, like Tom, there was just a feeling among, and again, we're going back to the 80s. When you went to a contest and you're sitting in the audience as a competitor and you're watching other people pose, you had the responsibility of doing a good posing routine. You may not be McAway, you may not be Ed Corney, but you had to do at least make the effort of doing a good routine, good transitions. Mm-hmm. And if you got music, it's got to be coordinated to the music. And if you didn't, like, you kind of lost respect, I think, among all the other competitors, you know?
Yeah. You know what? You bring up a good point, and that's exactly right. We did feel like there was a responsibility.
Yeah.
It was part of the deal. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was just part of the deal. You just had to do it. That's who you were.
Right.
And that's, as an athlete, that was a component of being a champion. And you're right. You didn't want to let down, man. You know, last thing I'd ever want to hear was getting off stage by another competitor saying, hey, you're in great shape, but your routine, what happened? The frig happened to your routine, man?
Right.
You know, you can't. It's back then, Tim Belknap would have come up to me and said, what's this about? You freaking earn that. You don't ask for it.
Right.
You earn it. Right. You don't demand the audience applaud you.
Yeah.
And that might have worked once, but it's gotten old.
Oh, yeah.
He would have been like, that's ridiculous, man. You're dishonoring the audience by doing that. You know?
Well, before I let you go, Tom, I want to talk to you about your 89 Olympia. How many times did you do the Olympia? Was it just that one time or was it one?
No, twice. I did it 89 and 91.
Oh, 91, right. Okay.
Yep.
So 89 in Rimini, Italy was the one you did where you did all the pantomime and it was almost like a movie.
Mm.
How did you come up with that? Tell me about that.
You know, if I would track it down, I would say that routine in 91, which was also something that, again, I tried to get completely out of the box with.
Okay.
What
was the one where you did where it was like you're pushing up or you're coming down?
Yeah, no, I had not been knocked down and I had to just wait and I did like come up with the weight.
Right.
And I got shot with a machine gun. It was like, I was telling some kind of crazy story.
Right.
Which I don't even remember to this day what it was. But much of that on both occasions were inspired by the music.
Okay.
The music. And because of, you know, the years of practice and being on stage. And the other thing that kind of led up to some of that was much of the drama that I was able to learn as a performer in Manhattan.
Mm.
I was performing with a group called, it was called Muscle Opera.
Huh.
And we had an opportunity to, it was myself, Gladys Portuguese, Nick Ballo, Ming Chu, who was a great bodybuilder at the time, chiropractor today. Brian Moss, who owned Better Bodies at the time and Better Bodies Model Management. It got me a lot of, I did a lot of commercial work in New York at that time.
Okay.
But we had this, and Carla Dunlap, which is the Miss Olympia. We had this group and we would literally perform at all these nightclubs, the top nightclubs in Manhattan.
Wow. Okay.
And yeah, it was pretty spectacular. We did some cool stuff. We did some Roman gladiator stuff.
Seeing pictures of that. Yeah.
Yeah. It was cool. It was fun. But you couldn't just get up there and just do a muscle routine. It was a performance. It was an act, you know?
Okay. Okay.
And so much of the drama that I would bring into the routine was inspired by that. And that I was also very fortunate that gave me so much like practice, stage practice.
Yeah.
And allowed me doing nightclub stuff allowed me to be a little bit more daring, a little bit more risque, a little bit more adventurous, you might say, in the routines.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a chance to really kind of work them things out. And so, that helped a lot. But the music for me has always been the key.
Okay.
And so one of the things that I've always done is this, if I hear back then anyway, and even to this day, I still, there's certain things that happen today that like are still part of my past. Number one, I drive past a great building that is empty. I'm like, oh man, that would make a great gym. I'm not opening another freaking gym. You know what I mean? I'm like, but boy, that would be a great gym if I was, you know what I mean? So that still happens. And also when I hear a piece of music, and usually it's not commercial music usually. And both those routines from 89 and 91 was music inspired by movies.
Mm.
91 was the soundtrack a part of, I blended it with another piece of music, but it was part of the soundtrack from Black Rain.
Mm, okay.
And so when I would hear something and I'd be like, ooh. And then I think I mixed that with something from the movie Lost Boys. Interestingly enough, and I don't want to bore you with this, but interestingly enough, the piece that I did from Lost Boys was a heavy saxophone piece with some singing and some lyrics as well about being cast off at sea and in the waves and having to hold on to this hope and fighting for like survival almost, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And the ultimate words was, I still believe, I still believe.
Right, I remember that, yeah.
Interestingly enough, that song was performed and the sax was performed by a guy, and I believe his first name was Brian. I can't remember his second name, but he was part of the Muscle Opera group that when we toured and did things in Manhattan, and he used to pull out, he had a live saxophone. He would like, he was very muscular, long hair. He was a saxophone player for Tina Turner, but he would perform with us and he would pull out his sax and he'd just like play his sax. I was like, I thought it was a prop. Holy crap, the guy's unbelievable. It's just amazing, right? So years later, his one of his pieces of music was in the movie Lost Boys.
And so
I pulled that piece, not because it was his, but just coincidentally. So I pulled that piece, I blended it with another piece, and then I would just listen to it and listen to it and listen to it. And the music itself moved me. It was like, it inspired. It felt like an emotion coming up.
Right.
And I knew this is the emotion. This is what I want other people to feel. I want them to feel this. So how do I bring that to life? How do I tell a story with that? And so I let the music evolve into the storytelling. And it was ultimately about someone who had been suppressed and held down and felt like the world was coming down on him. And ultimately, I even had someone do a recording that you've been found guilty by the high tribunal and sentenced to death. And I'm being like, I'm being electrocuted, right?
Yeah.
And then I'm reborn.
Yeah.
And wind up reborn. And that's when the I Believe song comes in. And it's a whole nother story. It's the rebirth.
Yeah.
The storytelling is a big part of it. But for me, it evolved as a result of the music. When I listened to the music, I could see it. I could feel it.
Yeah.
You know, and we've all done that. We've all had music where you close your eyes and heroic images or past images, things start to come up. And so if you translate that into how does that look on stage? How would I look doing this or that? And start to create the visualization process, listening to the music, it naturally evolves. Of course, you know, once you put it into practice, it's almost like a designer, a home. Like if I'm a designer, right, and I designed this magnificent home, now I got to give it to the engineers. And they're like, this is impossible. We can't build this. So now all of a sudden I get into the mirror in front of the mirror and it's just like, all these images I had, all this picture I had in my mind, how do I translate that? How do I put the mechanics into it to turn it into a routine?
Yeah.
And so really that was, you know, the music becomes the inspiration. I think that's something more bodybuilders need to look at today.
Yeah.
Get away from the commercial music that everyone's listening to and playing and find something that moves you. Movie music is designed specifically for that.
Right.
It's designed to create a mood, to create suspense and drama and elevate or take us down. And so why not capitalize on that? It's foolish not to, in my opinion.
Yeah. I remember going back to the 70s, Boyer Cole, he had a great closing routines back in the late 70s.
I love Boyer.
Yeah. And he would use Rocky sometimes. But he always told me, or I read in the magazines, Boyer would say, music is an emotion. So it should move you. And when you pose, you know, you should pick something that's inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did an interview with Lee Haney. And Lee talked about the first time he won the Mr. Olympia, he used the music from Excalibur, the movie Excalibur, about Arthur. And he said the reason he used that was when you see the movie, there's a part in the movie where King Arthur comes back to life and the country comes back to life. And it's like, oh, there's a new king now. And that's he wanted to convey to the audience that there's a new king now. I'm the new king. Yep. So it's amazing that he thought about that and he used that music and then he designed a routine. Remember that one part where he goes down and he's had his arms out. And then when he came up, that's when he used the music from Excalibur. And he used a different piece of music. And that was the message he wanted to convey. So it's great when you get so into it like you did, you know, and I still believe that that's a great message to come across. Bodybuilders can relate to that. You know, it's about believing in yourself. And
absolutely. And there's going to be trials and tribulations and challenges and setbacks, you know, but you cannot stop believing. And so that piece of music was just, it just moved me. And I think my brother had posed to it or another song. No, it was actually a different song. It was a song by Greg Allman that he posed to one year. And again, that moved me, his posing to that. And I think I used that Greg Allman song, and that might have been from Black Rain later. That was in 91 or so. And again, so the music has to move you. If the music doesn't move you, it's just something that you think. If, by the way, if for athletes, if you're if you're playing, if you're doing music or something just because it's popular, because you think the audience is going to like it,
right,
it doesn't mean it's right for you. It doesn't mean it's going to move the audience.
No.
And it's not going to necessarily convey your message. And I think ultimately, since I know we got to come to a close and I want to respect your time, ultimately it is about, number one, going back to presence, being completely authentic, and being able to convey a message that is your authentic self. Who are you? Because people say, you know, it's like, oh, it's too difficult. It's hard to put together a routine and then just, man, it's so nerve wracking to try. It's like, if I just go up there and do this, it's easier. You know what I mean? Sure, it's difficult. But if you want to be something more than what anybody else is, if you want to rise to the top, then you got to be willing to do what's difficult and what no one else is doing.
Yeah.
And to do that, that means being authentic, being your best authentic self.
Yeah.
And to do that, you have to be able to convey your message, and you have to be comfortable, and you've got to be certain about yourself on stage to be able to convey that message. When you can convey that message, this is who I am. Take me or leave me. I'm not going to change for anyone else. This is who I am. I believe in myself. I'm strong in that conviction. And you present that, my God, I'm telling you, man, I don't care how good or bad you are as a bodybuilder. The audience will be sold on your story.
Right.
And you will win them over. I've won over audiences. I don't mean to blow my own horn, but I've won over audiences that I didn't even place in the top 10.
Yeah.
I didn't place in the top 10 of the Olympia, but I got a standing ovation.
Yeah.
And I got invited to do the Grand Prix and do these, I mean, just dozens and dozens of guest posting for that reason.
Right.
That reason only. Otherwise, I could have went home with my tail between my legs and that would have been it, you know?
And as a bodybuilder, I mean, we have to be motivated to go to the gym. I mean, there's got to be, you know, it takes years of effort to build a physique. So that motivation has to come from somewhere. And when you see a movie like Rocky, I just saw that movie Rudy on TV again last week.
Oh, man.
I mean, it just moves you so much because this kid was so motivated to, you know, and as bodybuilders, we're motivated. Yeah. In order to build our physiques, there's going to be times when we don't want to go to the gym. And we got to find that motivation. And then getting ready for a show is twice as hard because now you're dieting. So when you get up there, you should convey that motivation. You should convey that willpower, you know, to the audience.
Yeah.
And if you can find a way to do that, I mean.
Absolutely. And again, part of it is conveying your authentic self, but also realizing, and this was Perry Powell for me, because again, any competition I've ever been in, regardless of the routine or the level of the competition, in many respects, was I always had in the back of my mind that I'm that kid sitting in the audience watching Ed Carney.
Yeah.
How inspired. And the difference, I got to tell you, John, the difference that made in my life, I was on a very bad path. And without that difference in mindset and motivation and inspiration, I don't know what would have happened.
Wow.
I'd be riding with some outlaws or dead today. Yeah. And so when I think about that, it's just like, it should be more than just about the muscle. It should be the presence. It should be who you are. And I think, guys, this goes all the way. This goes deeper. The routine is a message. It's your story in many respects and how you want to tell that story. But more importantly than anything else, let's go back to presence again, because presence has to do with how you care about everyone else and how you care about yourself and the message that you're conveying to the fans and to other people who may be inspired by the sport or what you're doing at the level you're doing it. And I think we have to become great curators of that we have other people's, not to sound arrogant, but we have other people's hearts and minds that we're responsible for in many respects.
Yeah.
And we have to know that we have the ability to inspire or crush. We can either let someone down or we can build them up.
Yeah.
And sometimes all it takes is a reaching out, a handshake. Hey, kid, you look good. Or, oh, sure, of course I'll sign that. Or having a routine that says, hear me so we can hear you. Because I think it was Marion Williamson said that if we allow our own light to shine, we give others permission to shine with us.
Yeah.
Be their authentic self. So that's what I would call upon athletes and bodybuilders today to do, to shine as bright as possible, to reach out, know you have the ability to inspire, and you may change some lives.
Yeah.
I know that sounds like a big responsibility, but you got the ability to be able to change someone's life, man.
Yeah.
Alter their path, alter their destiny. And you can do it through your routine and your respect for them and your love for them as an audience member and a fan.
And if you want to be a bodybuilder, it's about the art and sport of bodybuilding. So you have to show the art part of the too, you know.
Absolutely right, man. And you always did that, John. That's why I enjoyed being on with you, man. I have a tremendous respect for what you've been able to do, especially And again, in, you know, the natural bodybuilding community, you are a freaking single powerhouse, man. What you've been able to do and be able to rise above circumstances and not have any excuses. I didn't do this, I didn't do that, and that's why. No, you became a great champion regardless. And so that in itself is inspiring, man. And I, if I was still that teenage kid, I'd be picking up some weights tomorrow because of you, man.
All right, thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks to Tom Terwilliger for joining us. And next week, we will be back with Tom along with Sean Ray. And we'll talk more about posing, which is a subject that really does need to be discussed, especially in today's bodybuilding world. All right, before we go, I want to read this article by the Huffington Post Entertainment. It was from the January 12th, 2014 edition of that paper. It was written by Mike Ryan. It's called Remembering Arnold Schwarzenegger's Film Debut as Hercules. It says, two Hercules movies will be released in 2014. The first one, The Legend of Hercules, stars Kellan Lutz as the son of Zeus, and it opens in theaters this coming weekend. The second, Hercules, starring The Rock and directed by Brett Ratner, arrives in July. Barring some unforeseen turn of events, however, neither will have the cultural impact of an earlier Hercules film, a low-cost, just $300,000, 1969 feature called Hercules in New York. 45 years later, Hercules in New York is a cult favorite. This has everything to do with its 20-year-old first-time star, a man billed as Arnold Strong, who is known today by the name Arnold Schwarzenegger. Actually, Arnold was 22 when he made that movie. The plot of Hercules in New York is, well, the title pretty much sums it up, all you need to know. Hercules is in New York City, and hijinks ensue. Watching the film today provides an interesting early look at a guy we get to know a great deal about over the subsequent decades. Schwarzenegger is massive, bulky, and his English language skills are a lot worse than what we're all used to from Schwarzenegger. Frankly, he's not very good. So not good that at one point the producers decided to redub all his dialogue. In more recent versions, Arnold's original dialogue is back. Regardless, there's a boyish charm that's fascinating, and he's just trying so much that it's hard not to fault the poor guy. Also making his first debut with Hercules in New York was director Arthur Allen Seidelman. He was just 30 when he was hired to direct Hercules in New York for a salary of $1,000 a week, which was almost entirely filmed in Central Park. I think Arnold Wilson got $1,000 a week, and I think the filming lasted 12 weeks from what I remember reading. Honestly, when I first emailed the now 76-year-old director, whose credits now span over 50 movies, his next is Six Dance Lessons in 6 Weeks starring Gina Rowlands and Jackie Weaver, I didn't know quite how this request would be met. Contrary to popular opinion, not everyone likes talking about their first project. Let's compare it to if someone called you right now and asked you for an interview about a photo that you posed for in 7th grade. Seidelman's email response read, "It would seem an appropriate time to do so." Ahead, 14 remembrances and anecdotes about Hercules in New York. I'm meeting Arnold Schwarzenegger for the first time. The first time I met Arnold, I had breakfast with him at a coffee shop up on 72nd in Columbus. He was incredibly charming, as he has remained. He's a very engaging personality. And that's what these guys are up against in the new Hercules. He's just an engaging personality. Entirely open, affable, charming, even with his then very broken English. He was huge. I spent the first 3 weeks talking to his right arm. His right arm was as big as a person. He was a lot to look at. Beyond that, he was intelligent, sophisticated, and he did not take himself too seriously. On why Arnold Schwarzenegger was moving to the United States, I asked him why, what was his motivation. He said, "I want to make money." But he said it with a smile and charm. On Schwarzenegger's interactions with Americans, he was immediately engaging with any female who came within a 50-foot radius. On Schwarzenegger's work ethic, he was very serious about his work. There was no bullshit. He came to work every day and he wanted to do it well and do it right. You know, no excuses. He would just do anything you asked him to do and try his damnedest to do it and do it well. On the origin of Hercules in New York, the funding was provided by Joe Weider, who was the king of the muscle building programs. He was the guy who put the "Are you a skinny kid who gets sand kicked in your face" ads in the magazines. A lovely, lovely man. He was Arnold's sponsor. On Schwarzenegger being shirtless for most of the movie. I mean, why not? On working with no special effects. I used the veteran comic actor Arnold Stang, His reactions whenever I needed to convey the amazing feats that Schwarzenegger just did. Stang was a sweetheart. On a scene in which Schwarzenegger overturns a cab, which looks like a special effect. That was a cab with all its insides taken out. It was just a frame. On Schwarzenegger's on-screen fight with a man in a bear suit. Intentionally obvious. You've got to remember this movie was intended as a spoof, so I decided to do the bear sequence silly, I'll have to call it. On his favorite sequence. The sequence that amazes me is the chariot ride down through Times Square. I remember doing that just at sunrise, very early in the morning. I don't know if you could do that now. I'm amazed we got that sequence. On Schwarzenegger's dialogue being dubbed over in the early versions of the film. That was a surprise to me. The first release was with Arnold's voice. The film has made a lot of money for a lot of people. It's gone through a lot of ownership hands. And whoever bought it at that point decided that Arnold's voice needed to be replaced. So they changed his name to Arnold Strong, and they dubbed him. And it didn't work as well. Part of Arnold's charm was lost in the process. I had nothing to do with it. Did he think Schwarzenegger had a future in movies? No, laughs. I would not have predicted either an action star or governor. He really worked hard. Yeah, if someone would have stopped and asked me, I certainly might have said, with the right material, he could be fun on screen. But an actor? You would be hard-pressed to think of him as a serious actor in any way. Or doing things like Twins or Kindergarten Cop. That I would have been hard-pressed to conceive of. But the fact that he was charming and was willing to bust his ass to get it right, that was right there in front of you. On the legacy of Hercules in New York, the legacy of the movie is Arnold Schwarzenegger. If he's hesitant to discuss Hercules in New York. Well, I always find it amusing when I talk at college or acting school and the person introduces me with some of my more recent films and some kid will inevitably raise his hand or her hand and say, you directed Hercules in New York. That was a period of time when I was doing, how should I say it, more serious material, and I had gotten hopefully better at it. And then one day I'm in my office and I get a call from Arnold around 1998 and he said, Seidelman, which is the way he still refers to me. Do you have a poster of our movie? Actually, I had two in my garage. He said, I want to put one up in my office. And I said, done. And I had it delivered to him. And I said, fuck it. If he's going to put it up in his office, I'm going to put it up in my office. All right. Thank you, Pat Comer, for sending me that article that was entertaining about Arnold in Hercules in New York. If you guys haven't seen that movie, it's worth buying. Just to see Arnold's physique, he looks awesome. I think they filmed that, like I said, in 19, I think they filmed it in 69 when Arnold just, I think before Arnold went out to Chicago to meet Sergio. And then he ended up taking second to Sergio. But Arnold looks amazing. He's like 250 and he's huge and he's a little smooth, but he's not fat. Just, I mean, you can see the incredible physique and the incredible genetics of a young Arnold Schwarzenegger, 22 years old in 1969. And he's probably around the time, right before he won his third NAVA Universe title. And then he won his first IFBB Universe and then took second to Sergio, like I said. So just worth seeing just to see Arnold at his peak, or a young, big Arnold Schwarzenegger, at least. All right. So that's it for the show. We will see you guys next week. We do our interview with Tom Terwilliger and Sean Ray about posing. And thank you to Florida Alternative Medicine for continuing to sponsor the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks to all you Patreon donors. If you're interested in helping contribute to the podcast, just go to the Bodybuilding Legends Show website, bodybuildinglegendsshow.com. And in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see the link for the Patreon, and you can just contribute as little as $5 or $10 a month. So I want to thank all those guys who are doing that. I really do appreciate you guys. All right. We'll see you guys next week. Take care, everybody. Get back to the gym and start working out. And we'll see you next week. Take care.